Good morning and welcome to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. I'm your host, Scott Ventrella. Well, you know, we have been hitting on a bunch of different themes. As I've mentioned before, this program is really based on my current book, Me, Inc., How to Master the Business of Being You. And in there, we talk, among other things, I talk about the critical success factors that are so necessary in life. In other words, if we don't manage these things well, we have let's say, in terms of quality of life, I think it diminishes the quality of our life. So we've talked about, for instance, as we approach the new year, getting fit and you know, taking care of our health, relationships. We talked about career, and a lot of people, you know, thinking about either, you know, getting back into the workplace or you know, finding a new thing. People also that were thinking about retirement, and well, now that's kind of off the table. But today, we're going to be talking about the importance of giving and philanthropy, which really is a critical success factor for so many people. And today, I'm very pleased to welcome our guest, Kurt Welling. Kurt is the president and CEO of AmeriCares Foundation, based in Stamford. And Kurt's going to talk with us about his experience in giving. And Kurt, welcome to the show. I thought we could start at least, and I don't want to make any secret about this. I've known Kurt, I'm not going to say how many years, but quite a few years.
Long time.
And I also want to say that having known Kurt for as long as I have, he's the real deal. And so I'm pleased to have you here, and I'd love for you to share a little bit about your background, because you weren't always in the nonprofit space.
Oh, it's great to be with you. It does seem like it's been a longer time than either one of us wants to acknowledge. As I was listening to your preamble there, I made a resolution I have to start listening to your show, because just about everything you touched on there are things that are relevant to my own life and the life of just about everybody I know. So, no, I wasn't always in the nonprofit or the philanthropic space. AmeriCares is a 30-year-old emergency response and humanitarian aid organization, and I've been there, as incredible as it seems, 10 years, but for the first 25 years of my professional life, I worked in the investment banking and the securities business. So you can imagine that the transition from investment banking and securities to an organization which flies hundreds of millions of dollars of medicines and relief supplies around the world in 90 countries is quite a significant transition.
So why, after 25 years of a very successful career, did you make the switch? That's not an easy one either, going from the for-profit world into the nonprofit. And in fact, I remember being in my career, I was about 11 years into my career, and for-profit, earning a good salary. I really enjoyed the company, and then decided I was going to make the switch to the nonprofit. It was very, very difficult for me. But back to you. What compelled you to make a switch after 25 years of a great career and to go into something relatively foreign, in the sense that it's unlike the for-profit world, yeah, especially in financial services?
Well, I think when one makes transition like this, there's a precipitating event. There's something which actually nudges you over the line, even if it's something you've been thinking about. I think often, and certainly in my own case, the seeds were planted a long time ago, and there were seeds planted at various times in my life. I grew up in upstate New York, in Rochester, New York, which is really more Midwestern than it is Eastern. My family and my wife's family were both very oriented toward community involvement, both oriented toward participating in community activities and church activities and so on. So we had role models at a very young age where the idea of being involved and living beyond yourself was just an ordinary part of growing up. And over the course of growing up and then my professional life in the securities business, it became sort of logical and natural that I would spend some time working on some nonprofit things and charitable activities. And I remember quite vividly a moment. I was the chairman of a wonderful adoption child services agency in New York called Spence Chapin Services. And we were working on a set of strategic issues, and it came time for me to go back to my day job. And I remember thinking to myself, gee, it would really be nice if this was my day job. and I could spend an indefinite period of time working on that. And that was the seed that followed the upbringing seeds. And that sort of evolved into a not very well-defined plan that at some point, you know, the old great at some point, like at some point I'm going to lose 10 pounds, at some point I'm going to get in shape, at some point maybe I'll explore the idea of having a second career. And so that idea became part of my life list. And the problem, of course, is with a life list, as you get older, you either have to start doing things on your life list or you got to cross them off.
So this wasn't just something that, you know, on impulse. And I get that. That's very interesting that because I run into so many people right now in the business world, which is mostly the realm that I'm in right now, that are having similar kinds mm-hmm. of thoughts and driven by many different things.
Sure.
For some people, in fact, just one gentleman working for a very large global professional services firm said, you know, I'm just not getting any personal fulfillment out of what I'm doing. I enjoy the work, and obviously the compensation is great, but I'm not getting that personal satisfaction. I'm not sure if it's a function of age or those seeds that are planted at such early age.
Yeah, I think it's probably both of those things, and I think the proportion probably differs for each person at each stage in their lives. So some of it is clearly evolutionary. Some of it is becoming more introspective and more thoughtful and more aware, and personal circumstances obviously play a big part of it. Some careers are obviously more personally nurturing than other careers. So in my own case, I was in the securities business from the late 70s through the end of the decade, through 2001. And that was obviously a period of enormous growth, enormous change and dynamic. And I hasten to say, well, my wife characterizes me as a recovering investment banker. I love the time I spent in the securities business. I learned a lot. Many of my closest friends came there. But at some point, you move beyond the part of your life which is devoted toward accumulating and providing financial security and so on, and you go through a different sort of process of discernment. And so that's clearly what happened to me. It clearly was an evolutionary process. And I think, as is the case for most people that I've talked to about this, there's some amount of self-awareness and honest self-appraisal that goes on once you get beyond the point where you're either fully engaged in what you're doing or where you're fulfilled. And if you get to the point where you're not fully engaged and you're not fulfilled, it's a pretty clear signal that maybe you ought to be examining and looking to do something else.
So this process, was it, you know, months, years, and what was the final turning point for you, or defining
yeah.
point?
Well, like a lot of people our age, September 11th in 2001 was sort of a watershed moment. A moment where our perspective on many things individually and as a culture changed. I had this idea, which was becoming, if not sharp and distinct, better formed in my own mind, that I did want to have a second career in a mission-driven organization, a nonprofit organization at some point. But it was this notion hanging sort of in the back of my mind. And then September 11th, I was the CEO of a financial services company in New Jersey, and I was actually meeting on that day with some investors, and we were doing a recapitalization of the company at 8 o'clock in the morning. We were going through the final documents, and someone knocked on my door and handed me a note that said, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. And I remember thinking as an amateur pilot that it was the case and may still be the case that you can fly in unregulated airspace down the Hudson River and up the East River as long as you stay below a certain level and in certain corridors. And it always seemed crazy to me because sooner or later somebody's going to fly one of those planes into a building, and that's what I thought it was.
Well, I think of that baseball player, I can't remember his name, that played for the Yankees that did exactly that.
And then about half an hour later, they came in with another note saying another plane just flew into the World Trade Center. And obviously the shock and the horror of that moment and the impact it had on as I said, on our culture and the way we see ourselves in the world and so on was an emotional event for lots of people. And so I sat back and said, if you're really serious about this idea of a second career and doing something where you're contributing to an organization whose mission is to do good in the world, mm-hmm. you better get at it. And mm-hmm. And so that was the catalyzing event. And I hasten to say, I didn't have the slightest idea what it was going to be at that time, but I made the decision that I was going to move in that direction, which meant formally taking the step of leaving the financial services and securities business and going on this journey of discovery.
So, did you actually, resign, or you left the organization you were with at that time? In other words, you didn't. Of course, the conventional wisdom would say, "Well, look for your next thing while you're in your current thing." Right. But I'm not hearing that. You just left?
Yeah, I don't think, again, it's hard to say that one size fits all circumstances. In my own case, and I think in lots of cases, you really can't do the fully committed job of looking for something that's this magnitude of change. So I think the conventional wisdom, it's easier to look for a job if you have a job, is right if you're looking for a job like the one you have. If you're looking for a job which is a sea change, then there's some amount of personal discernment that needs to take place. And that was true in my case in spades. And there's some amount of research that needs to be done to figure out exactly what it is and exactly what the personal decision variable should be and what the criteria should be for evaluating that. So I did, in fact, disengage from the financial services business, worked out the transition with the equity investors that owned this little company, and set out on a journey which actually took me the better part of a full year before I was fortunate enough to find AmeriCares, and they found me, and that was 10 years ago.
So that was you performed a little bit of personal due diligence, yeah, so to speak,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I have, in this 10 years, my learning curve both about myself and about the whole concept of self-awareness has really accelerated, and I have come to be, and I've had the chance to speak with a whole range of people about this, including people in educational institutions, and of which I'm an alumnus, and so on. I think it's almost impossible to overstate the importance of sort of honest self-knowledge, and the earlier one starts to acquire it, the better. And I think that's true with respect to professional competition. I think that's true with respect to a discernment about what one's strengths are and how to remediate one's weaknesses. I think it's true ultimately about finding something which is your life's work or part of your life's mm-hmm. work that's really fulfilling, as opposed to sort of being swept along by the tide. And here I'm to some degree speaking from personal experience, because while I'm not proud of the fact, I can tell you that the first 10 or 15 years of both my post-educational experience and my first professional experience, I really wasn't terribly self-critical or self-analytical. I was sort of going along with the hand that I was dealt. Mm-hmm. And fortunately for me, I was dealt a pretty good hand. But the idea of really sitting down and examining your life, both with respect to your strengths and weaknesses and with respect to your aspirations, was something that really came to me later in life, before I made the decision to cross over, but it certainly accelerated after I made the decision. So it was the culmination of a process, and I think a really an important process.
So was AmeriCares was that just the natural choice, or were you faced with other choices where you really had to then make a decision?
Not only was AmeriCares not the natural choice, but it was it wasn't anywhere on my radar screen, and I. Unlike what some people might be motivated to do, would be to follow a particular passion. So if you are passionate about the environment or about children's services or about humanitarian assistance, then you would look to do something in that area. My objective was to find something that I could become passionate about, but where I could take my accumulated skills and make a contribution to the success of the organization. So I was looking both for the professional management and executive fulfillment, as well as the mission fulfillment, and it took me a while to discover that meant AmeriCares.
And so, were you also consciously looking for a top slot?
Yes, I was looking for a place. Yeah. Two things that I resolved without having any idea whether they were realistic or not: I was looking for a job where I could be a chief executive, and I was looking for a job where it was a real job, as most chief executive jobs are, not being a board member. In other words, I wanted it to be my full-time job, and I can tell you that I spend as much time and as much energy at AmeriCare as I have in anything that I've done in my life. So it's been very fulfilling and satisfying in that way.
We're talking with Kurt Welling, President and CEO of AmeriCares Foundation. We're coming up to a break. After the break, Kurt, would love to know a little bit more about the organization, your experiences with the organization, and then let's talk about what are the kind of people that volunteer their time, their energy, their resources. Love to hear a little bit more about that. We'll be right back here on 1490 WGCH.
Every day, in every corner of the world, people are in crisis. Whether it's a natural disaster, political conflict, or crushing poverty, they often lack the basic medicine and supplies they need to survive. That's where AmeriCares comes in. In times of epic disaster, daily struggle, or civil conflict, AmeriCares restores health and saves lives. For 30 years, their emergency response experts have been delivering critical medicines and relief supplies to millions suffering from natural disasters. They also respond to silent emergencies caused by hunger, disease, and despair. Right here in Fairfield County, three AmeriCares free clinics provide high-quality medical care for our uninsured neighbors. Whenever people are in need, wherever they are, AmeriCares is there. To learn more about how you can support the relief efforts, go to AmeriCares.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business of Living, the show that brings you strategies and practical solutions for managing your life and career. And I'm here with Kurt Welling, President and CEO of AmeriCares Foundation. Kurt, you took the big leap. You went into AmeriCares Foundation 10 years ago. Talk to us a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about the organization. And I'd also like to know a little bit about how were you able to adjust 25 years in the for-profit securities environment all the way to now the nonprofit, which is in many ways so very different. So let's talk about those two things.
Sure.
For a little bit.
Well, obviously I've had a chance to reflect on this, and this is a question that gets posed frequently. There are obvious differences between the for-profit world and the nonprofit world. And thinking about what are the most fundamental differences, I guess I would say two things. One is the culture of all for-profit organizations is the culture of profitability in the marketplace. So it's about identifying what your core products are, whether you're a product company or a service company, figuring out who cares about those, figuring out how to price them, what your strategy is, and ultimately you get the fuel that you need to run your organization in a marketplace, and the marketplace is relatively indifferent to what you're doing. What the marketplace focuses on is how much you make doing what you're doing. So there's a central marketplace where you can go for capital in the for-profit world. The nonprofit world is the culture of the mission. Everything starts with the mission. Why do we exist? All nonprofit organizations by law have to be oriented toward doing something which is going to help improve society in some way, you know, moral, educational, religious improvement of people. And so everything starts with the mission. And importantly, there is no central marketplace where you go for capital. So there's no price mechanism which votes on who's doing well and who's doing badly. And so the way you raise money is by telling stories. Mm. And so what you find is that the connection between the mission and the stories has to be very direct and has to be very powerful. Otherwise, you don't get the fuel that you need to run your engine. And so an enormous amount of energy and the cultures of the organizations reflect the fact that you can never get very far away from the central reason for being, because you're always trying to explain why you exist and why someone should care why you exist, because that's the way you're going to get them to give you some money. So it took a while for me to understand what all of the implications of that are, both in terms of how you need to be organized, how you need to spend your time as a chief executive, but also how you can make these program abstractions into realities. So you said, you know, why do people care about, we spend a lot of time thinking about why do people care about the disease burden in West Africa or South Africa? Why do people care about malnutrition in Asia? Why do people care about iron deficiency anemia in India? And for us, it's a question of whether we prosper or don't prosper, our ability to tell these stories well. So we spend a lot of time thinking about that. And ultimately, what it comes around to is someone who cares about that has personally made the decision that in their lives they need to care about something beyond themselves.
I've often heard, you know, there are a lot of nonprofits that help provide assistance within the U.S. And, you know, some people, do you run into this much where some people say, well, why should we care about what's happening over there? You know, Bruce Springsteen at the Super Bowl halftime show, it's the theme of his song was "We Take Care of Our Own." But is that, you know, somehow to me anyway, when I think about philanthropy, which in a nutshell translates to me as loving humanity, and should that be limited to our, you know, just what we're comfortable or familiar with, or our own country?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's one we run into quite a lot. I'm happy to say that we work around the corner in our free clinic programs throughout Fairfield County, where we provide medical services to 10,000 people here and uninsured neighbors who we see every day. Mm-hmm. We work across the United States through a network of several hundred free clinics, which we supply medicines and medical supplies to. But importantly, we also work in 90 countries around the world. I think it's – here there are no absolutes. I think how one defines the – target of one's philanthropy is a very personal decision. And I think there's almost no wrong answer to this. If people say to me, you know, we think your organization is wonderful, but we're really much more comfortable supporting our neighborhood organizations, my response to that is, I think it's great. I think it's great that you support something. And I think that's the important thing. Find out something that you care about enough to share your resources with, and it really doesn't make too much difference what it is.
I'll tell you one thing, and I had first heard about AmeriCare back in around 1986 or so. And one of the reasons why I have supported it over the years, and I don't know, you're the expert here, is that, you know, many times we give a contribution, and then you find out that, let's say, that $1, that only a fraction of that dollar actually goes directly to the aid. What I learned, at least back then, and I've been, you know, out of touch at least with some of the statistics there, is that much more of the dollar goes to the aid. And there's some, seems to be, you know, Bob McCauley, the founder, seemed to have a special knack for getting, you know, the right supplies, you know, medical equipment, et cetera, into the right place. And even very difficult countries like North Korea, as an example, just a special knack that seemed, you know, he had something that other charitable organizations simply weren't able to do.
Right, and we're proud of our record of efficiency and the leverage that we provide to donors. So, in the same spirit, I was just describing, you know, we raise money by storytelling. Part of our story has to be that we're good custodians of the money that you give us. So, we take very seriously, as all nonprofit organizations need to do, that we really are entrusted with this generosity by the people who give us their money. We're blessed that we have been able to grow Bob's original vision. So we receive donations of first-run medicines and medical supplies from over 200 companies. And so we're able to take the cash that people entrust to us, and we're able to use that cash to deliver medicines and medical supplies. So part of our value proposition, to use the terms of the marketplace, is if you give us a dollar, we're able to deliver 15 or 20 times that dollar in terms of the value of medicines and supplies and services that we provide, whether that's in our Norwalk Free Clinic or in free clinics across the United States or in one of the countries around the world in which we work.
And you also mentioned operating efficiencies, which is so – because so many, for-profit and nonprofit, run so inefficiently when you think of cost due to poor quality and poor processes. How do you – there's so much need in the world, and I just came back from Tokyo, and I was struck by how there's still collections going on for the people devastated by the earthquake, the tsunami. How do you select? You know, everybody has their hand out. Everybody needs help, and we're in a terrible economy. How do you? That's got to be very difficult, I would imagine, as CEO, because I would imagine also that ultimately, I'm sure there are other people involved in the decision, but somebody's got to make a decision. We're either going to focus here or there. We can't be in 100 different places.
Right, and it's a great question. And in the world in which we work, the world of global public health, where there are 2 billion people in the world that don't have access to basic medicines and healthcare and medical supplies, that die every day from, you know, millions of people die every day from things that they could walk down the street here in Greenwich and get at a CVS pharmacy. part of Bob's genius in starting AmeriCares was to understand that this was a huge problem that needed to be focused on, but also that it was not a problem that any one organization could solve. And so he was fond of saying to people, just because you can't help everybody doesn't mean you can't help somebody. So go help, go find someone that helps, that needs help, and help them. And so we prioritize and select countries based on a number of things. We're an emergency response organization. That was how we were created. So often we end up going to a country in the context of a catastrophic emergency. Think Japan after the tsunami. Think Pakistan after the earthquake. Think Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. And then we develop relationships with local healthcare providers there. And we end up staying. And we end up being an important part of
that. I would imagine that wreaks havoc with your long-term planning, and because you never know what's going to happen, when, and what part of the world.
Yeah.
We've got just a couple of minutes. I'm curious. In terms of your personal experience, because I know that we were chatting just a few minutes ago prior to the show, you hop on some of these planes. You're not getting the first class treatment necessarily. But any particular experience that kind of sticks out in your own mind on a personal level?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me was the extent to which traveling the world, I've now visited almost 40 countries, 38 or 39 countries in the time I've been at AmeriCares, has changed my understanding of the dynamics of the world, the relationship between people who are fortunate and people who aren't. And I hasten to say, if you're born in the United States of America, it's like winning the lottery relative to most of the rest of the mm-hmm. world. And the way in which people live, but also the dignity that is a fundamental human quality that you find in all of these circumstances, and particularly some of the most difficult circumstances. So I first flew into Darfur in Sudan in 2004, and in that flight, actually, I slept on the cargo in a cargo plane. And I remember in this excruciating humanitarian crisis, which is still a humanitarian crisis, being inspired, lifted up by the spirit and the resilience and the irrepressibility of the kids. So here you were in an environment where a couple million people that were living in these unspeakable circumstances, where hundreds of thousands of people literally were dying. And the kids represented this sort of pure humanity, this pure, resilient, positive, hopeful human spirit. And that's universal. And that's an extraordinary thing to be exposed to.
What a great testimony to the power of the human spirit as well. How about a golden nugget for the day, or for the week, I should say? Golden nugget for the week, Kurt.
Yeah.
Word of wisdom.
Yeah. Well, I think I've become a big believer that expectations govern an awful lot of what we do in life. And I've become a big believer that in setting our expectations, we need to challenge our perception. And so I think it's important for all of us to question what we really know and how we know it, and to separate things that we have come to believe because someone told us something or because we had an impression versus what we really know. And if you do that regularly, you come to perhaps some different perceptions and some different conclusions.
Kurt, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning. We've been speaking with Kurt Welling, President and CEO of AmeriCares Foundation. Thank you for joining me today. Remember, you only have one life. Why not live it on purpose? This is Scott Ventrella for the Business of Living Show. See you next week. So long.